Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. You guys, I hope you guys are doing fantastic because I have a guest, and you could see if you are on the podcast, meaning you're listening to the audio, you can't see it. So I'll tell you what you see. But if you're on YouTube, for example, or on LinkedIn Live, whatever you are watching, you could see in the back there, it says landlord coach. And that's what he is all about. We're with Mark Delfini. Mark, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's great to see you, Ishai. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. You know, before we dig into your very exciting story, if you could give us the 2-minute elevator pitch, who you are, what is your business, tell us.
Well, the irony is, with a moniker like landlord coach, I don't actually want to make people into landlords. I actually want to make them into, first and foremost, business owners. Would love to make them into investors, but I would love to make them into moms and dads and soccer coaches and people who want to do, you know, things that are most relevant and important to them. I want to make them, I don't want their life being defined by how they make income. I want their life to be defined by their life output. So really how I do that, I teach them something I call the time wealthy advantage. I wrote the Time Wealthy Investor 2.0 a couple of years back, but I really teach them the time wealthy advantage, to teach them how to get more white space on their calendar, how to get more control over their calendar. And I do that using the VIP method, which is vision, infrastructure, and process. And we're gonna dig into that, I'm sure. But that's what I'm about, and that's what's important to me.
Beautiful. And gonna help so many people who want to get into business and make their life eventually, obviously. It's all about making your life better. And that's what we're gonna get into talking about. You know what? Tell us, because it sounds like a very unique combination between coaching, life coaching, I would call it, and business coaching, serious business coaching, and real estate. And that gets me to talk about your story. How'd you get into this whole thing? When? What happened over there?
Well, I'll tell you, you and I have a very similar connection, and I grew up in upstate New York. I know you're downstate, you're in the city, but I was only grew up about an hour north of there. But when I left New York, I joined the Marine Corps, and while I was in the Marines, I traveled around a lot, saw a lot of different opportunities, saw a lot of different things. I really grew a passion for real estate and entrepreneurship. And I did 4 years in the Marines. Marines were very, very good to me, very good for me, and decided I was going to get out, and I decided to go to Indiana at Purdue. Of course, this is all the days before, you know, the internet was very, very new, and you know, that was exciting. I didn't have any idea where Purdue was, where Indiana was, but I'd been around the world, but I didn't know where Indiana was. But anyway, I decided when I got to school, I started investing in real estate while I was there. I learned how the banks loaned money. I learned how to buy real estate using creative means. And by the time I graduated from Purdue 4 years later, I had had about a dozen rental units all together, which was about $500,000 worth of real estate. And that is when my real education started, because I did it completely and totally wrong. I had fabricated a bunch of jobs for myself. I took on these properties with very, very little margin, very, very little room for error. I was using other people's money, which is fantastic, but what wasn't fantastic is I didn't have any actual cash on the side, because I was deploying it all to try to get to leverage my money as much as I possibly can. which isn't a bad strategy to a point until the market turns, and it'll always turn against you. It always does. It's just the nature of the market. And
tell me something
before
we continue the story. And I really want to hear. If you could give us a little bit of a timeline in terms of which years were that, meaning in the beginning, you were in the Marine Corps. When was that?
I was in from 97 or from 93 to 97. So I got out in 97 and then
I think we're 96. The same age because I was in the Israeli army.
Okay. So yeah, I'm 49. So
I'm 48. Pretty close. All right. That's the so I aimed correctly. So, you know what? And before we continue that, because I have so many things to, because you jumped a few topics already.
Yeah.
And the timeline like jumped up and you have a very exciting story. And I wanted like, hold on for a second. You went to the Marines and is there anything that you could tell us that you could take out of that experience that taught you for life?
Man, there were so many. I mean, honestly, first and foremost, it was about believing in myself. When I first got there, you know, I had grown up with a pretty, my father was an entrepreneur, self-made man, and it was hard living under his shadow because it was always, you know, if you kind of got into a jam, you know, it could always rest back and, hey, Dad, what should I do here? Well, in the Marine Corps, they want you to be self-sufficient. They want you to be self-contained. Yes, they want you to operate as a team. But ultimately, at the end of the day, they don't want robots. They want people who have the ability to think and think on their feet. And when I got into in the Marine Corps, I was selected for navigation school. So I was actually I was a navigator on C-130s. And at the time, GPS wasn't that prolific. You know,
maps.
Now we have it on our
maps
phones.
Maps and stars.
We navigated celestially. We had a sextant. Navigated by pressure and it was unbelievable. But anyway, all that aside, it was fantastic training because it really, really taught me to rely on myself and then be self-sufficient, self-contained.
And you said that, you know, once you learned all those lessons, you went to Purdue University, very nice. Okay. And then you started getting into real estate, and you found yourself, you know, going into real estate and buying properties. Could you tell us what type of properties were in the very beginning and what type of deals you got into?
Yeah, I was mostly focused on single family dwellings just because that's what I felt comfortable with. And I saw a huge demand for that where people were, you know, even though people were wanting to rent apartments in this particular market, and every market's different, of course, you know, every market is vastly different. And having grown up in New York, I grew up in upstate. So, you know, people rented houses up there. They didn't really rent apartments. I mean, there was apartments, don't get me wrong. But the housing market would, I mean, you could fall in love with the occupancy numbers very easily, where I would often have people moving out the back door while someone was moving in the front door and I'm trying to clean and paint in the middle while that was all happening. And it was very, very, very attractive occupancy rates. So my first couple houses that I bought were very, very easy for me to manage because it was just me. I didn't really need a robust infrastructure and all that. But the problem was, as I kind of started talking about, was the fact that I had created all these different jobs for myself, which was terrible. And that's really what limited my growth. And that's ultimately what led to some massive problems in 2008.
What can you tell us a little bit about that? Oh, by the way, before you tell us about that, you know, what you went through 2008, which I'm very curious to hear. You said that people gave you money and you started, meaning being a guy who used other people's money, the OPM system. But being so young and being unknown and being, you know, out there, how did you do that? Meaning before we get into the problems, but how did you actually manage to tell people, meaning I'm a young guy, I barely do anything, and give me your money and they say yes. What was the skill that you mostly, you know, used in order to do that? And what did you learn from it?
Yeah, of course, this was a little bit different. This is back in the banking before, you know, Dodd-Frank and all that. This was very, very early in that. But all of it was bank money. All of it. That's the OPM I was talking about. But I learned how they operate. And from that aspect, I it's still the same thing. I just needed to know what the rules of the game were, and I just learned to navigate the rules within, you know, hey, you know, what is it you wanted to see? Okay, let me create the conditions so I can make this easy for you to say yes. And that's really all it was. It wasn't anything more than that, but I had to learn, which some of the things are still true today. I had to learn in the residential borrowing world what a debt to income was, what that meant, and how they actually calculate it. Meaning there's actually a front end ratio and a back end ratio. Most people don't know that. They just know debt to income. They don't know that there's a front end ratio and back end ratio. You know, obviously loan to value, obviously things like, you know, how much money they're going to want to need to see, how much, you know, these are all the things. And of course, as I was getting more of a rental portfolio, you know, they weren't taking 100% of the rents. They were taking 75% of the rents and then discounting it that 25% and then expecting me to still make my debt service. So these are all things that I learned along the way. And I was thinking, well, that doesn't make any sense. Well, it may not make any sense, but that's how they were underwriting it. That's the rules that they operate under. So even though the rules are going to continue to change. I mean, the way they did the banking in the 50s wasn't the same in the 60s and the 70s and so forth. So banking will always evolve. And the more people that get screwed, the more rules are going to stack on, right? So of course, 2008 saw massive rules that got instituted. But realistically, there's always going to be a set of rules that people are going to operate under. And right now, money is very, very loose, especially in the private sector, not just in the banking world, but also in the private world.
Tell me something. You spoke about 2008. We all know what happened. You know, we all know how it collapsed. And I'm a big researcher of that, you know, collapse of that, you know, recession.
Right.
Which was tremendous, which could be so much worse. And it was contained in a way, but not contained, eventually, because so many people lost their jobs, homes, and more than that. What happened to you?
Yeah. So leading up to that, I had actually been able to create a portfolio where I actually had 92 rental units. So I had about $6 million worth of real estate. And as I'm growing this, you know, business that I had, it became this Frankenstein monster that I couldn't control anymore. Because what I had done, every time I took on a new unit, I didn't recognize that there was a whole other set of complexities that come on every time you bring on a new client, right? And it all started to swirl. And what had happened was I had created this massively inefficient job that no one person could do. But it was all, I was the single point of failure in everything, because I did the leasing, the showings, the opening the mail, answering the phones, returning the emails, doing all the maintenance, doing all the showings. I mean, it was just it was impossible. It was absolutely, absolute madness.
No ability to scale.
None whatsoever. And as a result, you know, and I hear this often right now where I talk to mom and pop investors and they think that they're limited by their ability to borrow. They're actually limited by their ability to scale. And they don't realize it. They don't recognize it because they become so stuck in operations. You know, the four core functions of every business, you've got your marketing and lead gen, you've got your sales, you've got your operations and accounting, right? So you've got those four core functions, marketing, lead gen, sales, operations, accounting. If you're going to get stuck, it's always in the operation. You get either stuck in someone else's operation in the form of a job, or you're going to get stuck in your own operation in the form of about 50 little jobs. And that's exactly what happened with me, is I got stuck in the operation of all these little jobs that, well, I'll just do it because it'll take 5 minutes. I'll just do it and it'll save a little bit of money. I'll just clean that apartment because I'll save the $150 or $200 and do it myself. You know, I'll just paint it myself and save the $300 or $400. That's, you know, well, here's the stark reality is that I didn't recognize that there was no way in the world I'm ever going to get wealthy by doing $15 an hour, $20 an hour jobs. It's just not going to happen. And that's what I was doing over and over and over again. So once I started to recognize that my time was worth way more, that if my job, my time was actually worth more like $50, $60, $70 an hour when I was acquiring properties and doing the management decisions, I was actually costing myself, you know, $35, $45 an hour. You know, now it's a much bigger differential because I make a lot more. But when I was doing that $15 an hour job, that's what I was paying myself. I was like, well, crap, no wonder I'm broke, right? So when 2008 came along, I was doing everything on this 92-unit monster, and there was just no way to keep up. And combine that with the fact that I was so over-leveraged, not just in time, but financially, you know, I had about $150,000 in cash sitting aside on a $6 million portfolio. I mean, I was woefully undercapitalized for, you know, for the eventual
thing.
What
was the LTV on those properties, average wise?
Average was probably around, I'd say around 85%, something like that. It wasn't so much.
It's not crazy. It's high, but it's not insane. Like the subprime, right, you know, sector.
Right. It wasn't super crazy. I can't say that I was underwater, and I really wasn't up leading up to that, but I did not have near enough cash. I did not have near enough cash set aside because I was looking to deploy as much capital, as much cash as I probably could to buy more because I was just stuck on stupid. I mean, did I need more than $65,000 a month coming in to, you know, I mean, if I had that free and clear, would I have needed more than that to live my ideal lifestyle as a 32-year-old guy or a 30-year-old guy? No, not even close. I didn't need anything like that. But the fact of the matter was, because I really didn't have a clear vision in terms of where I wanted to go, I just kept buying more because that's what you do, right? You just grow for the sake of growth. And that is what put me really behind the eight ball in 2008.
And tell me something, just to get a vivid idea of what happened. You were getting an amount of, let's say, X with evaluations of 80, meaning let's say the LTV was, 85%.
Right.
What did the recession do to that LTV? Meaning where did the valuations hit you where your NOI or after debt service,
yeah,
where did it find you that you said, oh my God?
Well, so the last round of funding that I got, I was doing, so many of them I was picking up either subject to the existing lien or I was doing them on land contracts. So that's generally how I was growing most of those. So some of those I was at 100% loan to value. So my average was probably around 85, but some of the last ones I picked up were, I was just basically the only money that I had into the deal was any fixing up or anything like that I had to do on the property. So that I was trying to fund out of cash flow, but because the cash flow was so lean on some of those properties, you know, I might have only made $100 over PITI. So, I mean, it was absolute madness what I was doing. And I didn't understand the risk that I was taking when I was taking on all those additional properties. Furthermore, some of the local community banks that I was borrowing from were loaning me money based on future appraised value.
Right.
So I was buying properties, $50,000-$60,000 that would appraise at that, and they would loan me that purchase price, and I would walk away from closing with $3,000-$4,000 in my pocket, which was, I mean, if I had just stopped for just a second and just stopped trying to grow, I mean, even if I just pressed the pause button for maybe a year, just to assimilate this, let the cash flow mature a little bit and set aside. You know, I mean, if I had 10% in cash, I'd have been fine. I would have not only succeeded through 2008, I would have thrived through 2008. But again, I didn't recognize the risk that I was putting myself in because I just didn't understand it well enough. I didn't know enough to not to set that kind of money aside.
So tell me something. So you find yourself in this position. So where are you? Post 2008, okay, I find myself, you wake up in the morning, Mark wakes up in the morning and says, hey, that's where I am. What do you do from there?
Yeah, well, I'd love to say that it was like, oh, well, you know, it was a beautiful event and I worked it all out and it was just, you know, rainbows and butterflies. No, I ended up losing about 2/3 of my portfolio in about 8 months. Wow. So I turned a $6 million portfolio into about $1.5 million. Unfortunately, very quickly into a complete barn fire. So I kept working. I worked harder. Of course, that kind of stress just took a toll on me. I actually got double pneumonia and almost died in the hospital because I was working so much. I mean, it was absolute craziness. But, there's a lesson in that, right? And, you know, I have a strong faith and I just thought, okay, there's got to be some lesson in this. And as I'm sitting in the hospital, I'll never forget this, sitting in the hospital, and the, you know, I've got double pneumonia. The hospitalist comes in, looks at me and says, look, someone who's, and this is, I'm 37 years old at the time. She looks at me and she says, you know, some people who look like you don't sit in hospital beds like this for this, right? Something's going on in your world that you need to take a really hard look at. And I was like, okay, I hear you. Well, as I'm sitting there, I'm going to be there for several days. This little nurse comes in and she says, I got to give you a shot in the stomach. To which I replied, you need to work on your marketing. I said, no, you are not.
That's a good one.
No, you are not. And she says, well, I said, well, what's this for? And she says, well, you're going to be laying in bed for the next couple of days. And, you know, we don't want you getting blood clots in your legs. And so this is Coumadin to thin your blood, blah, blah, blah. I said, well, tell you what, how about the thing you got me hooked up to is on wheels, right? And she said, okay. And I said, well, how about I just get up and walk around every few hours and, you know, I won't leave the floor or anything, whatever. She goes, okay. So she takes her needle and she goes away. Not long after that, another nurse comes in with another needle for something else. And I guess the steroid that they had me on was prednisone. And I guess that messes with your blood sugar. She says, well, your blood sugar is too high. I said, well, okay, well, what's it supposed to be? And she tells me, and I said, well, what, you know, I said, well, what am I supposed to be at? And she tells me, I said, okay, tell you what, how about I just eliminate sugar and carbs for today? Tomorrow morning, check it again. If it's too high, then you can give me the insulin. So she takes her needle and she goes away. But the interesting thing is, I'm sitting there and I'm watching, of course, I had just, you know, I had read the E-Myth, I, you know, all about systems. It's all swirling around in my head. I knew that I needed systems, but the fact of the matter was, even if I had a place for people to work, you know, someone to work, like, what was I going to do? Walk them into a room and yell, do work, and then run away? I mean, it was all in my head, right? As a typical entrepreneur, everything was in my head. And as a result, everything was very reaction-based, right? So I started to think about the, you know, kind of what was really wrong in my life. And at that point, I realized that things landed pretty much in three buckets, one of three buckets. One was I had no real processes for how I did stuff. It was all very reaction-based. I just reacted to whoever was yelling the loudest at that moment in time, okay? So I had no defined processes. Next, I really didn't have any infrastructure for operating a business. I mean, I didn't have any desks or chairs. I mean, I was running this all out of a truck with a laptop stand and an air card, you know, for internet access. So, you know, so even if I did have help, you know, people were saying, oh, you really need to get help. Well, what, like I said, I didn't have anywhere else to, I didn't have anywhere for them to go to help. I mean, it's not like they were going to ride around in my truck with me. So I didn't have any processes. I didn't have any infrastructure. And then finally, as I'm realizing my life, I mean, I had been successful enough in the corporate world where I could have gone back to that, but you know, why was I doing this in the first place? Why was I doing this? I mean, I could have been successful doing lots of different things, but really, what was my vision for my life? And that's, and those, at that time, it's really, I didn't really name it this, but that was the vision infrastructure process method that I wrote about in the Time Wealthy Investor 2.0.
Tell me something. Before we start talking about what you develop, you know, what you've developed from this whole thing, which is the landlord quote, you go back to investing in real estate from that point, meaning are you doing it today? Or you just go, meaning what type of assets would you do today?
Yeah, so I stayed, so after this, I, you know, started digging out. I was able to keep about a third of my portfolio. They were all single family. I did have one commercial property, which was a 16 unit apartment building. And that really helped me. It really helped me kind of get, I mean, everybody that got in, I didn't declare bankruptcy, although I probably should have, but I was just morally opposed to doing that. If as long as I could still work out of this, arguably I probably would have been out of it a lot faster had I declared bankruptcy, but I was just opposed to it. I just didn't want to. So as a result, I just got a shovel and started digging. And, everybody, you know, I walked around literally wherever I went, I had this thick stack of my credit report. So, and everybody that called, I had notes and everything else, and they were super impressed that I knew who they were. And, oh, I talked to Jan yesterday on this date, on that. And they were like, holy crap, like, you get this guy's super organized. But as I'm standing in the middle of Lowe's, you know, on, you know, with my papers on a stack of, you know, paper towels or whatever, I was like, yeah, I'm not getting caught behind on this. But the point is everybody got in line and everybody got something. So, but as a result, I started growing back again. But I stayed in the single family dwelling space just because for me, that was easy. It's what I knew. It was what I knew well. I looked into some commercial stuff. I own my own office building here in Lafayette. So I do understand commercial, but really where my skill set is, my passion is in the residential space, you know, residential single family. But you know, to that end, I knew my lane. I knew what I was good at. I knew my skill set. Could I have shifted my skill set to commercial? Yeah, I probably could have. But this is what I knew. And I think it's important that people recognize where they're strong at, that they need to stay in their lane, stay with what you're good at. Don't feel like you have to dabble to be successful. That's what's been true for me anyway.
So you own a little bit of commercial, but basically your expertise is the single family, especially after what you went through, and you obviously perfected, you know, this whole system for yourself. And then you came to build a system.
Right.
The system is called Landlord Coach, and you've written books, and you've written different systems and different paths and whatever.
Right.
Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, I would love to say that, you know, like I said, with the VIP method, and as I'm sitting there in the hospital trying to figure out, you know, what was all wrong with my life, I would love to say there was like, you know, that the birds flew across, you know, the window in the sky in the shape of a VIP, you know, that it was spelled out in birds or, you know, whatever, but it wasn't that way. It was actually, it was just starting to get the beginnings of, I really need to get clarity in these three areas of my life. So first and foremost, fortunately, as I was in the hospital, the first thing was, you know, my vision for my life was survival. Let's get healthy. Let's get out of this godforsaken hospital bed and really get clear in terms of what it was that I was trying to accomplish. And with that level of clarity, and also obviously to get everybody paid, to get in front of this thing, to get my debts paid down, I really got clear in terms of what it was that I really wanted from my life. And that was really, really important. So I got clear in terms of my vision. I didn't really call it that in at that moment in time. I actually did some studying and some researching, and you know, that kind of came later in life. But then I started to set up these infrastructure, you know, the pieces of infrastructure in my life. And that was really the desks, the chairs, the software. I got a small office. So ironically enough, I had another property manager who is a competitor that actually rented an office space to me, and we were friendly competitors. I mean, he was a very, very, very good to me, very, you know, just very helpful. Never so much as loaned me a dollar, but he gave me $1 million worth of education. I mean, I'm very, very grateful to him. And I started to build my business from there and got infrastructure, got an office, got desks, got chairs. You know, I was really clear on my infrastructure. And I would love to say it was easy at that point. It sucked, you know, and I really worked hard to make sure everybody got paid. You know, judgments still came along, and I got those paid along. You know, everyone say, hey, look, just get in line, I'll get you paid. And that's exactly what I did. But and in terms of the processes too, it was really important that I got everything out of my head onto paper and define those processes so other people could do that job and I can go out and do the things that I was best suited for. So in that context is why I wrote the Time Wealthy Investor 2.0. And this VIP method can work in any business. It can work in any small business. You know, I currently coach other people who are not just in single family dwellings or in rental properties, but also, you know, people who are contractors and other people who have other types of businesses, coffee shops and so forth and so on. So, and they use that VIP method to construct their ideal business and ultimately deliver their business vision or their personal vision for them.
So, you know what? I want to take two examples now, you know, taking your expertise and your know-how. One, let's say have hypothetical Charlie and then Joe. Okay. Charlie is a real estate investor. He wants to get into real estate and he needs your help. He wants to become a landlord. He wants to do that side of the thing, you know, and to use your method in order to become a much better landlord and to move it up as to become a business. And then we have Joe, okay? And Joe has a random business. I don't care what. Like, you can choose whatever topic you want. A cell phone business, doesn't matter what.
Sure.
And he wants to do that. I just want to see if you could give us an example, how are you going to walk these guys through the steps according to your VIP method to get them successful, to help them at least, to push them to become successful?
Yeah, it's you know, ironically enough, it's the same method. It's the same methodology. So first and foremost, I would say, you know, Larry and Joe, what's your vision? What are you trying to accomplish? Why, you know, what if you were to wake up tomorrow morning with $300 million in your bank account, what would you do from day to day? And usually people will land, well, I'd go buy, you know, okay, go buy all your toys, go buy all the stuff, and you're probably going to still have plenty left over. What's your day-to-day life going to look like?
Right.
And the interesting thing is, for many entrepreneurs, they struggle with this answer because their default setting is to go do work. That's a tough thing for them, because especially if you're an entrepreneur and you're in a small business, this is all you think about. You think about it in the first thing in the morning. You think about it all throughout the day. You're working throughout the day. Even when you're supposed to be, you know, having downtime, you're still thinking and ruminating about that. In fact, I just got off a coaching call this morning from a guy who's got a roofing business, and he really doesn't have a whole lot of interest in real estate. He thought he did. You know, that's when he approached me that he wanted to get into real estate. And I found out that this guy had 6 or 7 different businesses. None of them were running particularly well. And I said, dude, what are you doing this all for? And the interesting thing is, after he's got more free time because of the infrastructure and processes. We'll get to that here in a second. But because he's got these infrastructure and processes in place now he's got more free time than he knows what to do with. And as a result, he's engaging in a little bit of self-sabotaging behavior of, well, I'm gonna go insert myself into this business now. Like, dude, you don't need to do that anymore. You don't need to make these daily decisions. You don't need to get up on roofs anymore. You don't need to go do this stuff anymore, because now you have an infrastructure and process in place. This is where you need to go back to your original vision in terms of what it is that you're doing this for in the first place. And he struggled. He really struggling with this. And I'm thinking, look, this is where you get clear. So we spent a lot of time saying, look, you know, if you were to, you know, let's go back to when you were 16 or 17 years old, you know, when this was all really, really important to you, that you had a successful business. What did you do with your free time back then? Right. That had nothing to do with business. And he's like, holy crap. You know what? I have not allowed myself to dream in so long, because my dad worked like a dog for so many years. I just thought this is what you're supposed to do. I said, man, we don't live for our businesses. Our businesses exist for us so we can have a life. So all of a sudden he started talking about, well, you know, I really love cooking. I love to cook. I love to do all this stuff. So I'm telling you, when I have this conversation with people about vision, they're not being really honest with themselves about what they really want, because they've not allowed themselves to be, right? So let's pretend that Joe and Larry here have a clear vision for what they really want to do. Okay. Now we're going to start to design an infrastructure and process for them that is going to be in alignment with that vision, because I don't want to design an infrastructure. Like let's say, for example, that Larry's vision is to lay on the beach, rubbing cocoa butter on his belly, you know, sitting on the beach of Spain, right? May not be a great visual, but it's a good vision nonetheless. But so Larry's laying on the beach, rubbing cocoa butter on his belly for 2 months out of the year. Well, that's going to be a terrible experience for Larry if his infrastructure is set up where he needs to return emails and phone calls in a timely manner, right? So this is why you got to have a really clear vision for what it is that you want in the first place. So the infrastructure that we're going to be looking at is, okay, so specifically, Larry, where does information have to flow through you in order for something to happen? Where does information have to flow through you? That's the toll booth. That's the gatekeeper for where, okay, so now let's just pretend that we've got this, you've got something identified. I don't care if it's Joe or Larry, or if he's selling raisins or real estate, I don't care. It's the same thing. Where does information have to flow through you in order for something to happen? So now I'm going to look at that bit of data, that bit of information that has to come in, and I'm going to look at it, and I'm going to do one of three things with it. I'm going to either eliminate the task because it's not relevant. It's not relevant to delivery of the product to my core purpose of what business are we in, right? We have to know what business we're in first and foremost. We have to know who my client avatar is, right? And should this task be done? Is it that important to my end user, right? Is this task, so first and foremost, I'm going to eliminate the task if it's not relevant. If it is relevant, and some people will argue with me, no, there, coach, I really need to send out those birthday cards. Those are really, really relevant. I'm like, okay, so this person's been living without a refrigerator for a week and a half, but you want to send out a birthday card? Ouch. Okay, yeah, get this right. Get that right first, right? So first we have to eliminate all the tasks that are not actually delivering the thing that you're in business for, okay? Secondly, you look at automating it. Is there a way that we can automate that task so it removes you from the decision-making process, so you are only making the most important decisions? And when you automate, guess what? You make it massively consistent, much more consistent if you can automate, rather than the third one, which is delegating. Delegating it to someone who is either a virtual assistant or someone who works alongside you, where you're not the one making the decision, where the information doesn't flow through you, but it flows through that person. So again, you either eliminate the task, you automate the task, or you delegate the task in that order. And the reason being is there makes no sense to have a task that is being done, whether it's automated or delegated, because that task is irrelevant. So you eliminate the most irrelevant tasks. Secondly, you automate the task, and if it can't be automated, then you delegate it to someone else. And usually delegating is it's also the most inconsistent, but it's also the most expensive. So that's where I look at those tasks being done.
Employees are most expensive to their
Absolutely. Business. That's exactly right. And then, and that's really it. I mean, so in terms of infrastructure and process, you know, that's the system. That's the system that you reverse engineer, that's going to deliver your vision for you. And it's really not much more complex than that, but you're always looking, you know, for your listeners. And I know some of your, you know, your listeners tend to be beginners, you know, if that's really where you're at and you're in the beginning stages of putting your business together, you're always going to be looking for information has to flow through you in order for something to happen. So find a way. Can this be automated? Can this be delegated? But first of all, ask yourself that hard question. Is this a task that is absolutely delivering my core purpose to my ideal client avatar?
Tell me something. Once we got this mapped, we got, you know, all these three mapped, what is the next step in order to become successful, especially for people who do real estate? I understand that this is true for every business. But, you know, due to the fact that most of the people that are listening or most people interested in what, you know, I deliver is either actually commercial real estate or prop tech, could be technology, could be people with startups. So what is the next step in order for them to move towards success after they map those three things?
Sure. After they map them, well, so this is actually leading into my next book, which is still in the cooker right now. But so actually the VIP method actually has two additional things to it, which is actually spells out VIPER. So it's vision, infrastructure, process. The next one after that is execution. What measurables, what activity are you going to have in terms of execution? Because again, you might have this all mapped out, but you have to have some measurable metric, some activity-based metric that's going to actually move the needle. Otherwise, this is just all theory, okay? So you have to put some execution in place, and it's a little bit, you know, a little bit higher scale. But then the R is reporting. You have to have a reporting function, which is the meeting function, which means that you realistically, where most entrepreneurs struggle is, again, I mentioned the four core functions of every business. The marketing and lead gen is one, sales is the other, operations is the third one, and accounting. There's no one person that is going to be amazing at all four. Impossible. It does not exist. And if you think so, it doesn't happen, right? Because, you know, would I want my accounting person to be a salesperson? Heck no. Like that does... It's just different skill sets.
Usually it's also different personalities. It's true.
Different personalities. Exactly right. Just simply, could one person occupy a couple of seats? Sure. You know, if it's, you know, I occupy the sales and operational function in landlord coach, right? But do I do the marketing? No, I do not. Do I do the accounting? Definitely not. Even though I have an accounting background, I should not be doing the accounting function because I know I won't do it, right? If you're going to get stuck, like I mentioned earlier, if you're going to get stuck, you get stuck in the operational function. If you're going to ignore something, it's the accounting function. And it usually looks like this. Well, I looked at my bank account this morning and I have a little bit more money in my account this month than last month, so I must be doing okay, right? That's unfortunately what a lot of small business owners do. And that is not accounting. You know, if you don't have an accounting function, you don't have a business. And actually, Marcus Lemonis said that from The Profit. And I think he's spot on. I think if you don't have an accounting function, you don't have a business. So to answer your question, you know, about what's next, you know, the main thing is don't try to do all this all at one time. Look at your business like a Sudoku puzzle. Look at it and think, okay, where's the most information flowing through me and how can I get this off my plate? Especially if it's something that you're just like, I can't hardly get any work done because my cell phone rings all the time. So how could you get someone else to handle the calls? And it doesn't mean that all the calls need to be handled by that one person, but literally start to find ways where you can channel some of this stuff off. And I'll tell you, 12 years ago, there's no way I could even have this call because my cell phone would have been blowing up the entire time. And this was even days before texting was really all that prolific. So, you know, if you can imagine how much more distracting it is now with all the technology that's being filtered through our phones. So that's pretty much it. I mean, just look for ways where information is flowing through you and how you can either eliminate that, automate that, or delegate it to someone else.
This is very exciting. And also, you gave us a lot of insight and a lot of education. So I thank you for that. Sure. You know, before we go into the closing remarks, as we call, to say how you guys can find Mark and all that stuff, can you tell us, I know that you're out of Indiana. A lot of the listeners are commercial real estate. And it's a market that I've been looking at in the past. Could you tell us, you're there. Could you tell us a little bit what's going on there in your home base in terms of the real estate and the economy, et cetera, you know, your hometown, et cetera?
Yeah. So I live in a town called Lafayette. And it's not a big town. It's probably I don't remember the exact metrics on here. I think about 150,000 in the entire county. So it's not a real, real big area, but it's big enough. But most people like Indianapolis. They like because they like the metrics there. Here's what I will tell you that I love about Indiana. And I grew up in New York. You know, you and I both, we spent a fair amount of time in New York. When I came here after the Marine Corps, what I did not recognize, and I'm going to tell you a quick story. I went to go get my driver's license here, and I went to register my car here. And the gal at the motor vehicle, she says, oh, do you have insurance? No, I just need to see the insurance on your car. And I said, oh, crap, you know what? I didn't even think about it. I didn't get insurance for my car because my car's been parked for 2 years while I was overseas. So she says, oh, that's no problem. Go next door. They'll get you signed up for insurance. I said, okay. So I sit down. I'm 24 years old at the time. And I'm sitting in front of this lady. And she's like, well, how old are you? And I gave her all my information. And you could see this like pained look on her face. And she says, okay, well, you know, it's about the best I can do in terms of your age. She goes, well, it'll be $300. And I said, okay, well, can I pay? I'll just go ahead and pay 2 months ahead. I'll pay this month and I'll pay next month. And she goes, where are you from? I said, what do you mean? And she said, that's $300 for the year. I said, are you absolutely kidding me? I said, I'll still take two. I'm like, holy crap, $300 for the year. It would be $300 a month, you know, back when I had been, in New York. And at that moment in time, I realized what the cost of living was here because the taxes are good. The schools are decent. The crime's not absolutely crazy. We have good laws. We have a good legislature. You know, I'm telling you, I am so in love with this state. And people, you know, everybody complains about where they live and, you know, but I'm telling you.
What are the taxes over there?
Taxes are ungodly low. I will tell you this, just to give you some perspective. In the house that I live in, now granted, it's all apples to apples, but I'm just letting you know. If I lived in the same house that in New York, okay, the taxes with the homestead exemption and everything are about $1,200 a year, okay? That same house in New York would be about 15,000. Just to give you, again, we, yeah. and you know, just yeah. to give you just a little glimpse.
That would be in a medium medium, I would say, level area. And the high end area, it could go to $30,000
easily.
$35,000 a year. Yeah.
Yeah, and we don't live, and we're not living in a super crazy big bougie home, but you know, our, you know, that's where I'm saying, like, for you guys, it's just, you don't recognize how inefficient and how, and that's why, unfortunately, New York has a net decline in population, because people just can't afford to live there. It's got a younger population year over year, and just people can't afford to live there. But I'm telling you, I love it here, because you know, we really do love the policies and way things are going. And unfortunately, I just don't see that ship changing for anybody in New York. But I will tell you that that's not uncommon among the Midwestern states. And that's why there's so much coastal money is going into the Midwest, because it's just, you don't have to beg for your rights out here.
Right. And about the future of New York, that's a longer discussion. I'm hearing a lot of, perspectives about that. And there are many, many ways to look at it. But what I want to do right now is, Mark, if you could tell everybody, how can they find you? Meaning, obviously, you guys can see the links above, below, all around us. Right. You can click and see what Mark is doing and contact him directly. But Mark, if you could tell us.
Yeah, probably the best way is just honestly, go to my website. It's landlordcoach.com. It's pretty straightforward. There's a contact button you can just click on. If you're interested in just doing a quick discovery call, see what it would be like to work with me. Just fill out the application there just to get an idea. Otherwise, you can just drop me a simple email, mark@landlordcoach.com. Of course, I'm on Facebook. You can reach out to me that way. I'm pretty easy to find. So if you've ever got any question, I'm more than happy just to talk with people, because I'm really more about, like, for me, I love teaching and I love coaching. This is what I'm made to do. This is why I am here. There's no question about that, because I see so many people out there who are entrepreneurs. They're trying to do their thing. They've got a family business and they're struggling. Unfortunately, there's too many marriages that are failing because of the fight that doesn't happen when you're not exhausted, you know, because there's too many kids that are not seeing their moms and dads at baseball games and wrestling matches and all the things that are really, really important to them in their lives. You know, I just think there's too much focus on the wrong things. And this is why I have such a passion about teaching people and getting them a time wealthy advantage. So feel free to reach out. I'm happy to have a conversation with anybody.
And you guys heard it. And, you know, I can tell you, Mark, that, spending this, I would say 40 minutes, give or take with you right now was a pleasure. And I could say that you're a personable guy. And I'm sure anyone who could take your services could really enjoy it and learn a lot from you. So I thank you so much. I
appreciate that, Yishai. Yeah, thank you very much, Yishai. I appreciate that.
You guys, I hope you enjoyed it. I'll see you in the next show. Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.